Hello, everyone, and welcome to Exile on Bad Street, episode 23. And this evening is going to be a great show because I have two of my most requested guests that I had since I started doing the show last year because of their experiences in the wrestling business. And when I announced that they were going to be on the show, you know, a couple weeks ago, people were sending me all kinds of, you know, tweets and other messages on Facebook and whatever. Being excited, so we're going to get this thing on the road. And I am joined tonight by Mr. Scott Hudson. You may know him from his work in Global Wrestling Federation, World Championship Wrestling, Georgia All-Star Wrestling, which is my favorite run he was in. Anything else, Scott, that I'm missing?
I was actually a standby extra in the Tammy Sitch porn, but other than that, no.
And a man who was,
and he blew up,
and he blew
didn't
up.
You? He blew up, didn't you?
And a man who was a witness to one of the biggest debacles in wrestling history. That was
the Tammy Sitch porn. My apologies. I jumped the line. I apologize. I'm sorry.
Which I'm talking about is when WCW appeared on Monday Night Raw for the first time. And, oh, my God. That may come up tonight. I don't know. We'll see how it goes. But, Scott, how you doing?
Fantastic, Chris. Thanks for having me on.
Awesome, awesome.
Both of us.
Yes. And your cohort. The man who just cracked me up to no end when I was 10, 11, 12 years old in the early 90s with his Stephen the Truth character. And then a few years later, had a career renaissance in ECW as like this normal guy. Doing other things. But the man formerly Stephen the Truth, Stephen Prazak. Steve, how you doing?
Holding up, Chris. Holding up. You know, I'm trying to dig out from all of this all this Tammy Sitch misery here, and I'm in it deep.
Yeah, she was too. It was funny that Hudson's been, you know, on WWE Network, well, not WWE, ESPN Classic with the global stuff, but now you are now starting to appear on WWE Network now because they're uploading all the old ECW television. So no, you've won up to him. Oh, no, Hudson's on
I'm
Nitros.
So proud.
I think the Nitros are coming up, though, that you were on, Scott. I think they're starting to get to that era. But, yeah, you guys.
Well, my lawyers haven't weighed in on that yet, so let's just wait for the courts to weigh in and make their ruling. We'll see if that gets on.
Is that the law firm of Dewey, Cheatham, and Howe?
Pretty much.
Oh, man. Well, yeah, these guys, like I said, I remember them when I was growing up because they were, you know, big parts of my wrestling fandom as they were part of the Georgia All-Star Wrestling crew. This was spawned off of Southern Championship Wrestling on Channel 36, then Channel 69 in Atlanta. And, of course, they were members of the Atlanta Boys, Shinamaki, you know, Post, which we'll talk about later. But how did you two guys meet up? I mean, when did this unholy alliance take place? Scott,
if I recall, it was quite unholy it was too. It started, I believe, it was a rare WWF show at the Omni in Atlanta. I think it was late '85, maybe early '86, late '85. But anyway, uh-huh. It was a pretty sparse crowd. And anyway, Scott showed up with a notepad, and I showed up with a notepad, and I immediately thought, well, who else shows up with a notepad at a wrestling show but this guy named Dave Meltzer? So I figured this guy. Was Dave Meltzer. So, are you Dave Meltzer? He goes, from Tifton, Georgia. And I remember him from all of his references and, you know, in the various wrestling presses and whatnot. So we became friends from that point on, and we often showed up with dueling notepads. I often submitted to some of his notepad holds, which were pretty brutal. But other than that, we did. We became pals, and then from that time on, we just did a lot. I went to a lot of wrestling shows and whatnot, and especially some of the local indies, and one of the indies, which became which took place in Carrollton, Georgia, which is about near the border of Georgia and Alabama. So you have to set your watch back about 40 years. That's far west. You have to. Thanks. Anyway, we hooked up with our good friend Joe Pedicino, who Righties had started a nice wrestling block of shows, put a great collection of all the available non-WWF shows that were available in syndication, and put them all in this long, big block of shows that lasted, I think, went up to 7 hours at one time.
Nine and a half hours, I think, at one point it got up to.
Really? 9.5?
Yeah.
I do remember it went on for a long time. I do remember, though, the best show was always Memphis, and I was always damn last, that which was way too long for my Betamax tapes to go to the very end. But that was rather odd, but unfortunate. But anyway, he started getting involved in sort of quasi-promoting some of his own shows, because there are so many wrestlers in the Georgia area, most of them broken down, but still there are a lot of them around. And they put together a show, and then the show was not that all that great. But anyway, I'll let Scott take over where the announcing took place during that evening in Erin Carrollton. Go, Scott.
Well, first off, everything Steve just said was exactly right. I mean, that's exactly how it happened. And after that, when we talked about this before we went on the air, I hope you weren't recording that and this doesn't air, is that we basically work for nothing. Steve and I, we would drive up together, and Steve was the driver, and he would inevitably cuss out every other driver on the highway. Wait a minute, that was me.
No, I recall a vaguely different story than that, but in the interest of brevity, go ahead and continue on, please.
I'll go ahead and throw myself on the sword. I was the driver, and Steve was the victim. Is basically how it worked out. Is that I'm driving everywhere we went, and I'm cussing out every person basically in North Georgia. But we got there, and we're working for nothing. And the promoter was either Joe Pedicino, and then it eventually transitioned to Sam Kent. And Chris, you or any of your listeners to the podcast should do themselves the favor finding on YouTube or Daily Motion or Vimeo or anywhere, if you can find old North Georgia studio segments with Sam Kent and the beautiful, the incredibly talented Bonnie Blackstone, where Sam Kent was the co-host. That was the guy that Steve and I worked for, the guy that literally could not spell the word leopard or critter. To watch those booking seats in insanity, and so we're working for Sam, and we love Sam. I mean, I think I speak for Steve. We just love Sam to death. He was fantastic. He was insane, and he's still here in 2016, and he's been dead for 10 or 15 years or better. Yep. Still the butt of an insane amount of jokes from us. But he was fantastic. Well, that's what he worked for. He paid us $5 each for a month of TV, and that was enough for Steve to put gas in my car and me to get a half a dozen double cheese crystals on the way home. And that was it. And that was what we did for 5 or 6 or 7 years, I guess, working for Georgia Indies. But Sam was great, and I'll throw it back to Steve to tell you the name of the tours that the North Georgia Wrestling Alliance went on during those times.
They weren't really tours, just that sometimes when people look back at those old Georgia shows, the first thing they think that, God, the wrestling is bad. And and overall,
and the wrestling is worse.
It really kind of was. Mind you, there are some great guys on that show. There are some really good guys in that show. I mean, Eddie Gilbert came through, Joel Deaton, Steve Lawler, I mean, countless. I mean, Glenn Gubernetti. I mean, there were a lot
Black.
Of great guys. Yeah, exactly. Ron Starr. A lot of great guys put together some really good matches. But when the wrestling was bad, it was really, really bad.
Oh, yes.
And because unfortunately, because Sam also ran a wrestling school. And inevitably, when the guys would, and I think you know where I'm going with this. when as soon as the guys would pay their money for a wrestling school, Sam would put them on TV the next week. And these guys had a hard time putting one foot in front of another, much less being part of a well-coordinated wrestling match. And anyway, this happened so often that Scott and I, to try to give the show some credence, we couldn't exactly, do a completely whiffed clothesline. We couldn't exactly say, oh, what a brutal, brutal clothesline that was, even though it was pretty damn brutal in its own way. We ended up having a lot of fun. I mean, it's pretty much for our own amusement. By trying to keep things entertaining throughout the entire match, and that's pretty much what we tried to do. That's what we became sort of famous for having a good and funny time calling some bad wrestling.
Yeah,
and to the point
for no money. Keep in mind, for no money.
Yeah. And it was worth every nickel.
Yeah.
And we
exactly.
And interesting, and some of the to the point when we were promoting some upcoming shows, we would pretend like there were names, they were actors with these really cutesy marketing-esque kind of names that didn't even exist. We came up with them because there were things that Sammy Kent would say. Let me say, for one thing, he was trying to get Gordon Solie to be a special guest on one of the shows. And Sammy came up with this: I went up to Gordon Solie and offered a sucker's dick till his head caved in, but he wouldn't do it. So we started promoting an upcoming North Georgia wrestling tour. It's called the Till Your Head Caves In Tour. Please come by and see the Till Your Head Caves In Tour. And it was just an inside joke between us and Sam Kent. And Sam thought it was hysterical. And however the rest of the world, or however many of that were actually watching that damn thing, have no earthly idea what the hell we were talking about.
Oh, man.
And there are a number of other tours, and they're all based on the things that Sam Kent would say. Because Sam Kent was a really colorful guy. He had the diction of a small soap dish. But for some reason, he always put together a pretty good wrestling show. He assembled it pretty well, despite the fact that some of the talent was dubious at best. But there was enough good talent to at least keep it going. And it just went on for years and years. But seeing Sam Kent for the first time, my God, what some of our wrestling friends who we would trade takes with, or sometimes we would meet each other at big pay-per-views in Florida or whatnot, and we would show some of the stuff that we did, and they would see, pictures. There's Bonnie Blackstone and Uncle Sam Kent on the screen, and here's a guy, Sam Kent. He looks like Uncle Sam. He's got a picture of himself on his tie.
Yes.
He's got a picture of himself on his back of his jacket.
Yes.
And he's got a picture of himself on inside of the lining of both sides of his jacket. And he's got a wooden doll next to him that also looks like him.
Yeah, the mortal puppet.
This guy is a psychology textbook chapter also of himself.
I tell you this, Steve. Mm-hmm. Uncle Sammy, I live in Barnesville. You guys were just over here last month for the WrestleMania show. Uncle Sammy worked up the road in Griffin at Spalding Ford. He was the number one used car salesman there. And you would go And you would go in there to do business with Uncle Sammy, and right there on his desk with all the rest of his stuff was the Sammy puppet. Imagine not knowing, who this guy is, and you're going to buy a 1999 Ford F-150, and here you go into the office, and there is a puppet of this man who you're trying to buy a car or truck from, sitting on his desk, and he's wearing a jacket with his own picture on it. I mean, he's one of a kind.
Hey, it's marketing.
Yes.
This is 2016, and that was 1999 or before. And when you think about it, and not to get political, I don't mean to do this, but when you think that Donald Trump is leading one half of the potential presidential candidate slate for next November, and it's all about marketing. My God, Sam Kent 2016. How the hell do you argue with that?
Oh, I know.
Well, mind you now, Freddie Blassie used his wrestling background and some gimmicks, whatever, to sell cars when he lived in Atlanta for a while.
Yes, he did.
I got some shots of him at some Ford dealership there, I think in Midtown somewhere.
And of course, Dusty.
And there were some, and there was, yeah, he was using his wrestling bit to So, you know, I'd be curious how the used car sales records between Fred Blassie and Sam Kent really match up. That would be
Dusty would do commercials for Tom Stymus in Macon, and those are on YouTube.
And that's exactly right.
They're hilarious.
I remember him pounding the hood of those vans for the Tom Stymus ads and the Macon and Forsyth dealerships. Oh my God! I grew up in South Georgia. That was in our market.
Yeah.
So every time I see Dusty do a commercial for Tom Stymus, I'm like, hell yeah, that's Dusty Rhodes. Wait a minute. What am I saying? I'm 8 years old. I can't buy a van, but if I could, I would buy it from Tom Stymus.
Yeah. Now, Uncle Sammy, one thing about him is I'm so glad we're talking about him because, again, one of the pillars of my childhood. When I used to, and I would stay up for the whole block up until the 9.5 hours, you know, I would stay up all night long to watch this stuff. And usually, North Georgia, Georgia All-Star, whichever the name at the time was, it would normally air at the midnight hour or 11 o'clock hour, either or. And Uncle Sammy at first was a heel.
Now, wait a minute. Hang on, Chris. That's so we could get that highly sought-after Sunday demographic.
Yes.
You know, we want the Saturday night demographic. We wanted the early Sunday demographic, midnight to 1 a.m. Sunday morning. We beat the hell out of Joel Osteen and what's-his-face Stanley from First Baptist Atlanta. We beat the shit out of them.
Midnight to 1 in the morning. What the hell?
Well, that time period would have been like Paul Walker or Earl Polk, you know, going way back in.
Oh, my God. Oh, wow. I remember that. Oh, the old Tingle Tongue. Yeah. Wow. Whatever those guys. Jesus.
Earl Polk died, and I think Paul Walker, he got forced out or some type of deal.
Good.
But,
good.
Yeah.
There is a God.
Uncle Sammy was a heel. Okay. He, in fact, you know, if you guys never remember this. He, when Joe was NWA, Uncle Sammy took Joe's spot as Bonnie's co-host. And Bonnie never had this before. And it was great to see Bonnie was actually getting a chance to be on her own and not be Joe's sidekick. And her and Uncle Sammy were great together. And then when they turned Sammy babyface, which was a natural move, I mean, that was awesome. And the fans loved Uncle Sammy after that. I mean, he was like God in some of these towns.
Wait. No, I can understand Uncle Sammy, Sam Kent being looked at a little bit more appreciatively by the fans, but I don't think anybody really loved Uncle Sam.
Really?
not sure about that. Not sure about that.
Well,
but,
at least that,
but,
I think
so,
that
I mean, again,
he was. Because of his Griffin ties, I guess.
Okay.
Because they would run Griffin shows. I don't know if you guys worked those shows. I think Tim Dix did those shows. That's a name from the past. But, my Uncle Sammy, well, I mean, he was big time down here. So that may have been the local thing, but, he was just a true character. And it's a shame that a lot of this stuff doesn't exist on the internet. You cannot hardly find any of the 36 or 69 stuff in the tape trading community or either online. And, Scott, why do you think that is? You just think that a lot of people in the Atlanta area just wasn't recording and keeping it?
Well, you got to remember, this is, I mean, as we sit here in 2016, this is, God, almost pre-internet technology. And that means rather pre-TiVo technology and all that. And so you would have to sit there and work with your VHS recorder to record that stuff back then. So, yeah, that's probably it.
Yeah, but there's some stuff
actually,
that has appeared lately.
To be honest with you now, I have boxes and boxes of VHS tapes of a lot of that stuff. But mind you, I only started recording it only after Scott and I got on the show. So I didn't really record much prior to that. But no, I've got them. I just don't have nearly the amount of patience to spend to copy those old VHS tapes onto a digital format. But if somebody wants to give it a stab one time, well, we'll take it.
Man, the thought of a digitally remastered Sam Kent just throws me right out in the street.
Hey, we'll
I could run over by a bus.
We'll have to talk about that off the air, Steve, because I can do that stuff. But yeah, I mean,
famous last words.
Oh yeah, I bought a tape one time from a tape dealer in New York who advertised. He had WATL Block. That was the name of the tape. So I was like, oh shit, you know. So I bought it, and it had a little bit of 85, a little bit of 86, and a little bit of 1990 all on one tape. And
whoa,
yeah, the 1990 was like right after Joe took over and formed Georgia All Star, and the right. First, you know, like the first man I see on the screen is Gordon Clements, and another name from the past. But
Commissioner Gordon.
But
yes, him.
It's a shame that, because I tell people that never saw this stuff, you know, just how good it was. I mean, Pro Wrestling This Week has a good chunk of shows on YouTube.
Oh God, yes.
But it was syndicated out. But the old Superstars of Wrestling shows where you had, you know, Randy Rose and Nick Busick and Chick Donovan, who we'll definitely talk about a little bit. You know, guys like that were on there and just kind of like comedy routines. You know, it's hilarious. Hilarious stuff that it just got lost in the ether.
Yep. Yeah, I'm real surprised that because Atlanta is a pretty fair-sized market. I mean, this is the 17th or 18th largest city in the country. And so I'm just surprised at how little really exists. And even not so much the wrestling shows, but I mean, like a lot of the material that is not owned by presently operating television stations, it's gone. A lot of stuff is just gone. Because I think, again, just the cost of keep maintaining those old tapes was just too much. And we wanted to use the old tapes and old videotapes to record something a little bit more profitable and something that would be a little bit more sensitive than this pro wrestling nonsense, I guess.
Yeah. Now, when did you guys first hook up with Pedicino? What time period would that be?
Oh, wow, Steve. I'm guessing about 1990.
Okay.
Maybe.
Really? Okay.
So that was basically the birth of the Atlanta Boys in that time period.
The Atlanta Boys were already beginning to galvanize. If that's a good word. It's probably prior to that, because we all met each other under very similar circumstances at a wrestling show, and we had some similar backgrounds. We were of similar ages, and that we all seemed to gel from there. And that's where the Atlanta Boys got together. The Atlanta Boys got a lot more noisy come the early '90s when WCW used to do their TV tapings at the Center Stage Theater.
Oh yes! Oh yes!
Yeah. That's when we got a little noisy, shall we say?
Now you guys, Craig Johnson, you know, y'all were John Horton, of course. You guys were always the guys in the front, the public faces of the group. But how many guys were members of the group altogether?
Oh God! Here we go. That was Steve and I. And Lou Ledinsky, Greg Jarman, Gary Lynch, Steve Cohen, John Horton.
I guess the rest were auxiliary members. Oh.
And Rob Britt.
Yeah.
If we can find him, if we can find
one. Auxiliary, yeah.
what prison he's in now. But that was it. Steve and I, Lou, Gary, Greg, Steve Cohen, Rob Britt, John Horton, that was us. And we were all just massive marks for anything to do with wrestling. And at the time, we understood what a total, just god-awful dog fart what WCW was putting on was. And we thought, well, if there's any hope for this company, it's that the fans will grab it by the balls and sling it around the city of Atlanta right off the top of the Bank of America building and say, somebody pay attention to this. That might be the only prayer they have. So we did that. And we did everything we could to put over this horrible product. And it worked. I mean, I take full credit for the NWO, for Goldberg, for Brett, for Flair, for everything else, was because we pulled them out of the muck and the mire of 1990 and 91, 92, and, you know, of of Dead Eye Dick searching for Stan Hansen and PN News and just
Black Blood.
The complete and utter bullshit and Black Blood. Oh, my God. Yes. And we pulled it out of that and said, my God, would you please understand, this is everything that's left of Crockett Promotions and Paul Jones and Saturday Night on WTCG in Atlanta. Would you please stop with Johnny B. Bad and PN News, for the love of God. Here we have you by the balls. Would you please save this company? And we did. I mean, straight up, we did.
And what's funny about this whole thing is that, you know, three of you guys were faces on were on television wrestling doing this stuff.
Correct.
So we were faces.
That's exactly
we were
right.
Faces, we were faces on Atlanta TV, which doesn't exist to the rest of the world. So I don't think, there's nobody watching it in Peoria going, hey, wait a minute, aren't those the guys from Georgia All Star with Uncle Sammy? But I'm sure nobody was.
John had the USWA. Run and
the thing is we were never ever on screen, with the exception of one notable time when both Scott and I showed up at a center stage taping still wearing our white shirt and black tie from our respective jobs, and we were right in the middle of the shot
and Ole who
was booking at the time actually stopped the taping, was wondering what the hell we should do. Actually, held the taping up for like 10 minutes because of us. I found this out about 2 months later. I was like, oh my, he could just have asked us to move. I thought that could probably have worked, but for some reason, I don't think they looked upon us as any antichrist or anything like that, but they didn't see us as any genuine troublemakers because we were enthusiastic. I mean, we were cheering and booing, which is what they wanted the crowd to do. We were just doing it at different times.
Now, this was 90 or 93 only run.
Yeah, that's about 92 to 93, I believe.
Okay, so that's
we walk into Center Stage Theater for like a few weeks or maybe 2 weeks of TV taping. And they were still doing squash matches back then.
Oh, yes.
Hang on a second, Steve. And first, let me say this. My God, was it fucking cold.
It must have been
70 below.
Thank you.
We're waiting outside that building there in Midtown Atlanta. My God, it was cold.
Not the best section of town either, too.
Yeah, well, I thought it was fine, but then again, considering some of the places Georgia All Star put on shows, this is what. But anyway, so the first thing we do is we walk into the Center Stage Theater. I go up to the promoter, who's Chip Burnham, and ask, "Hey, Chip, how many matches on the show tonight?" He tells me 28. I go, 28, my lord! And how many Greg Sawyer squashes could you possibly use in Georgia? And apparently there are at least five, poor guys. So to keep ourselves somewhat amused and conscious, that's where some of the peculiar chant started up. And there was a spell there during the latter period where Crockett had not hired any new guys for like months. It had been like months since anybody new came into Jim Crockett Promotion. And the first guy to come in new after a long, long period of time was somebody they billed as Tex Salinger.
Oh, the legend.
And I saw him. This was at a show in Gainesville, Georgia. And I was there. Finally, a new guy. Looking forward to this. This should maybe liven things up. Bell rings. Tex throws a punch. Grabs the headlock and sits down for 10 minutes. What the hell? he just took a show that was slowed down to a crawl and added rigor mortis to it. It was just hell. And from that point on, Tex Salinger, who for some reason morphed into Tex Lazinger, became a sort of weird cult hero, anti-hero, some sort of damn hero of us, even though he didn't really contribute an awful lot to the thing. But again, for our own amusement, and again, still trying to be enthusiastic of the product in our own way, that's when we sort of made Tex Lazinger a superstar that would last a lunchtime.
And I found, I just found that match in the results archive. He beat Joey Maddox.
Wow.
Really?
September
really?
9th, 1992. That's Texas' first match. On a show,
I got to tell you, Tex was, Dennis Knight, who ended up having the huge run, was a I'm not going to say not a bad worker. He was a great worker. He did a terrific job with the character, and in the ring, he was solid. But because he didn't have that chiseled look, he wasn't ripped out of rock. He didn't have, you know, six-pack abs and a butt chest or whatever. And we thought, this is the guy. And we never had, like, some kind of corporate meeting of the Atlanta boys, like, okay, who are we going to vote on, like they used to do for the NWA World Heavyweight Champion. You know, like, it's going to be Tex. There's no discussion. And it was Tex the whole time. And then they put him with Shanghai, and that just worked. That just worked with us because the moment Tex would tag out, the second he would slap the hand of Shanghai Pierce, we were chanting, "Tag out Shanghai," while he's trying to get his heat, you know, and trying to get the heel offense. We're tag out, but he's looking up like, "I'm on the offense. Don't you get it?" And we get it. Tag out, and that it was just wonderful. And the thing is, we had, I won't say all, but we had the majority of fans at Center Stage with us.
Yes, they were called heroes.
And the sad thing is, without any thought at all, other than walking in the front door, we had done better booking than WCW had done at that time.
Well, I think
it was sort of repairing the booking that was there. I would think Bobby B.
Yeah, also in that Gainesville show, Shane Douglas and Pat Rose had to work twice because Pat Rose screwed up a Shane Douglas belly to belly.
Well, I can tell you, if you're going to screw up a belly to belly, you better do it with Shane Douglas and Scott Steiner.
Oh, God.
That's true. I was going to say, those two guys are both pros, and if they screwed it up and come out and do it right the second time, Scott Steiner would break your neck. So
yeah, and you know, and talk about Shanghai. Yeah, Mark, you know, Shanghai Pierce, of course, was a Henry Godwin, Mark Canterbury, who
right.
was a really, really good talent, really good worker.
Absolutely,
had that great injury. I mean, he was really strong in the ring, and they were so fun. Of course, the Shanghai origin was masked, and then they unmasked him, and they actually, I think you guys should definitely take credit for that little push they did actually get later on. Where they actually got a little spotlight.
It's funny because actually I met Tex a couple years later at he was backstage at a North Georgia show in Rome, and he wasn't very happy to see me. So I really don't think he felt that his career really lasted any much longer because of us. Maybe a week or two he got an extra out of the deal, but I don't think Tex Lozinger has a little Scott and Steve shrine in the corner of his head.
Yeah, but I'll tell you this, Chris, that Dennis Knight, and I'm in full candor, I don't know what happened to Mark Canterbury. He's a terrific guy, a great hand, and deserved every dime he got in this business. But Dennis Knight is now like a fine dining chef in Tampa.
Really?
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Believe it or not, Tex Lozinger, if you go into a linen tablecloth, linen napkins, you know, you order a deck of cards, they bring you 52 trips type restaurant. That's Dennis Knight. He's the executive chef, in the back of the house. So I'm proud of Tex.
If I were to walk into the kitchen and scream Tex at the top of my lungs, it wouldn't be a good idea then, huh?
It'd be like,
I don't think you'd get that far.
It'd be like that scene.
It would kick you right back out onto Dale Mabry without even blinking.
Yeah, it'd be like that scene in Caddyshack when the chef told by that Al Cervix that it was dog food, and the chef was going to go out there and die. So that's what you would be on that, Steve, but. Center Stage was such an interesting place. The crowds were so different at so many different times. Whether, you know, sometimes it would be a heavily black crowd, sometimes it would be mixed. Then you had the time period.
All right, here we go, Chris. Let me destroy the myth for you. And I won't step on Steve at all. If he wants to jump in, that's great. But Center Stage, when they started doing TV at Center Stage in 89, it was a fantastic idea. It was a great venue.
Yes, it is.
I mean, centrally located. It looked fantastic on television. And then they, like the WCW was prone to do, oh, well, if it works great once, let's do it a million times. It'll work just as well that way. And that never ended until the very end, by the way. But what they did was, well, let's just do it every Tuesday night. And so then you would have, and Steve and I can and I hope Steve will back me up on this, as we're standing out literally in the 75 below zero temperatures out in front of center stage, that you would see school buses drive up to the front door of center stage because admission was free.
Yes.
It didn't cost anything to get into those Saturday night television tapings. And they would unload all of these inner city's kids to come watch wrestling, which kept him out of trouble, and God bless him for that effort.
Yeah.
It worked.
That's great.
That worked as an idea to keep kids out of trouble on the streets of Atlanta. That was a fantastic idea and 100% successful. But as a wrestling audience, can you imagine that bunch putting over the Z-Man? It didn't work. It just did not work. But that's why that happened.
And as time went on, they didn't bring the kids in too much. And sometimes, even though the admission was free, there was all of a sudden there were patches of empty seats. So as time went on, they would actually, I think for a number of weeks, they would hire pretty models.
Yes, that's what I was going to get the models.
Just to fill the seats. They would pay people to sit there and scream for Z-Man.
And Chris, I would like to point out that is exactly how I got my gig in WCW, as being a pretty model that was bought in to WCW TV taping. That was it.
One night, WCW did actually pay me to go to a center stage show, because when Johnny B. Badd would shoot off that little confetti cannon, there was money inside there. And what landed in my lap were four $20 bills. WCW paid me $80.
Let me break the news for SEC Scoops or WrestleZone tomorrow. That is more than I made for any WCW TV taping. My God, I worked there, for God's sakes.
Oh, man.
I'm hardcore. There
we
go.
But yeah, I mean, Center Stage could make guys. I mean, Center Stage made Harlem Heat. I mean, that's a fact. They made Scorpio.
I agree.
Yeah, I mean, they made those guys, getting behind them so hard like they were. I mean, it was one of the most interesting venues I think I've ever been to.
WCW has no fond regard for that theater. They hated that theater. Everybody, all the production and management there, they hated Center Stage Theater for some reason. Always called it a dump, a toilet. I'm sure there are nicer places, certainly, but I know for what they needed to have done, that was the right place at the right time. They got it for a song. It's probably one of the best investments at WCW, in all honesty, I probably ever made. And
Chris, let me tell you this. During that period, during the late 80s and the first half of the 90s, was a transition for professional wrestling, not only as a product, as a booking venue, but as a venue that you were seeing the denouement, if you will, of the Cow Palace in San Francisco, of Reunion Arena in Dallas, and that sort of thing. And Center Stage became that sort of venue that people would come to Atlanta. I'll tell you this, and my apologies to Steve if he doesn't want to hear this, but my nephew is a singer in a country band called Home Free, and they played a show at Center Stage last November, and they sold the place out, and we went to see it, and one of the singers said, you know, I can't be in this venue without saying this. Let me tell you something, brother. And he did. He went into the whole Hulk Hogan bit. And as we sit here in 2015, that everybody knows Center Stage from wrestling.
Yeah.
And that was eye-opening to me. I love those guys. I love my nephew. And But when you hear another guy, not my nephew, who doesn't know me from Adam, to put over center stage because it was a wrestling venue, it worked. Everything played out. And WCW, for all their fits and starts, they put center stage over as a marquee venue for professional wrestling.
And even when they tried to, you know, they would go out and venture into other cities in Georgia to tape television. They would go to Gainesville or go to Macon or go to Perry or go to Columbus. And then they always end up going back to center stage.
Civic Center.
You know?
The Cobb Civic Center. Don't forget the Cobb Civic Center.
Oh, definitely. Cobb County Civic Center, another great venue as well. Oh, okay. Man. That's been many a show there. But, I mean, yeah, those were some interesting areas. But I want to go back to Georgia All-Star real quick. The talent there, I mean, a lot of young guys, Bagwell, as Fabian, got his first, you know, big break there. Of course, Glenn Gilberti, Disco. And this mixture of those guys with guys like Billy Black, Joel Deaton, Festus. Billy Starr. Festus. Hey, Festus and New Jack as a tag team is one of my all-time favorite tag teams ever. Mustafa,
I think the last time I saw New Jack, he said he's still working on the ulcer that he got that day when he was still tagging with Texas.
Mustafa was there as like this silent African headhunter managed by, and you'll love this callback, Danny Dees.
Whoa!
Danny Dees was people. We talk about Sammy Kent. People need to see Danny Dees because he was like the quintessential Southern heel manager from the early 90s. I mean, he was.
Now let me say this, Chris. I will absolutely toss to sea for this as a foodie, as someone who loves to cook and fancies myself as some kind of high end chef. Made the greatest foodie reference in the history of pro wrestling on a North Georgia wrestling show.
Oh, that would be the one at the Alpharetta Auction Barn?
Yes.
Oh, that's because Uncle Sam wanted us to put over the chili that they sold at the Alpharetta Auction Barn at the concession stand. So unfortunately, Scott left it to me, which was a really bad mistake. So I said, I'll tell you, Scott, I don't know if you know this, but Jerry Lee Lewis, yes, the Rock and Roll Maverick himself, one day had some of Harriet's chili, and the very next day, he wrote Great Balls of Fire. I don't know if you knew that, Scott. But so Sam Kent was not amused, but he was laughing his ass off the entire time. But I'm not quite
and
sure.
And this is Sam Kent, whose idea of fine dining is Denny's
or Waffle House.
Actually, I believe the story that Scott wanted me to say was not that one. I think you were thinking of a different one, weren't you? Were you thinking of that one, or were you thinking of the Pawpaw's Country Buffet or something?
Well, that would have been the one where he was talking about how rich he was, Danny Dees, where he talked about how he had eaten. Go ahead, Steve. Go.
Yeah, he was the heel manager at the time, Danny Dees was. And he was I talk about how he's living the high life. He's going to this restaurant, going to that restaurant, ordering only the finest filet mignon. And he's like, the filet mignon? And the very next promo, he's talking about the Blazers, which is Sugar Ray Lloyd and
Artie
and,
Swain.
Who's the other guy?
Artie Swain.
Ridiculous Dork Swain. Yeah, that's what they're about. But anyway, it was going to be a hair versus hair match. And Danny Dees, on the mic, threatened he was going to shave R.D. Swain baldless. which was met with complete and utter silence by everybody. Which I believe one of the persons was Ronnie P. Gossett, and Ronnie P. Gossett is never silent. So you know that really is really connected.
Ronnie P. Gossett. Oh, what a, you know, I don't know if you guys have ever seen his shoot interview he did with a High Spots. Have you guys ever seen that?
God, no, I have not. I'm dying to see that. Probably, I didn't know it existed.
Well, he leaves. Nobody is left unburned. He is, it just goes completely nuts, just shooting on everybody. I mean, he's out to bury everybody he can bury. And, oh, man. And Ronnie P. Gossett. Oh.
Well, you got to tell me, Chris, does he bury Steve and I? Because, my God, we got along with him great.
Yeah. You guys weren't brought up. He was mainly going after Memphis guys and, you know, Goulas guys and stuff like that.
Yes.
Jeff Jarrett. Oh, Lord.
God.
Jeff Jarrett, but. I recommend you guys.
I'll tell you this. I adore Jeff Jarrett. I think he's just he's it. He's it for me. He's the top of the list. And for Ronnie P. Gossett to bury Jeff only buries Ronnie P. Gossett.
Yeah, Ronnie.
Well, the thing is, Ronnie Gossett, when you talk to him, as entertaining as he is, you knew everything he said was bullshit. Everything he said, he was so entertaining in his delivery that you just sat there and listened to it because the whole presentation was so enjoyable. So, but I knew that he was just one outrageous, unbelievably piece of crap another. But he was just so damn interesting. So he just sat there and let him fly. He was something to see.
But I will say this: I got a note today from Ronnie Gossett, not Ronnie P, who has gone on to his greater reward years ago, but Ronnie Gossett, who was an independent Southern promoter, announced today on Facebook that he was in a relationship with some lady. And I got to tell you, she's fantastic. She's beautiful. I'm looking at this like, Ronnie Gossett has someone like that? My God. He's the best worker in the history of the business.
Calm down. He probably met her on some Russian dating site.
Fantastic. Perfect. Or Nigerian.
That's an interesting word.
Nigerian still has a global money. Maybe that's where he's going for.
That's a great segue. Because when you guys were in Georgia All-Star, you know, all the sheets and stuff was reporting about how Joe Pedicino had found this.
You're welcome, Chris, for that transition. Yeah, by the way,
had found this Nigerian backer, Oluwole Oleyemi, and they were going to buy the USWA. They were going to do this, that, and the other. They were going to run this national promotion. Blah 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 blah. You know, ESPN contracts, this, that, and the other. And then there was no money. And is it safe to say, Scott, that Joe was the first guy to ever get swindled by a Nigerian scam?
That is not safe to say, because he was probably the 101st person, but he was the first person to do it on a wide scale. And I'll defer to Steve for the rest of the story, but suffice to say, he was victimized by Olu Oleyemi. This and make a note of this, Olu Oleyemi. That's the guy's name. If he wants to sue me, come on.
He's still alive.
You're one of those guys.
Wait a second. I've got the impression that I think Joe told me they never actually spent any money. They never actually paid Olu Oleyemi any money, so they didn't really lose any money with this.
And that's exactly right. What Steve is saying is that he was the ultimate nutshot to those West African fraudsters that literally in the 90s and 2000s consumed an awful lot of time with the FBI and the ATF and the DEA and everybody else about fraud, that he was the first person to say, you know what, that's catch it. How about this nutshot? I'll do it myself. And it worked. He was the first person to tell them the horse you rode in on, and he tried. It didn't work, but he tried.
Yeah. I mean, it was a big deal because, I mean, Joe had left, you know, under bad terms with the NWA, needless to say, earlier in 90, that Jim Herd wanted him to turn heel and become the Liar. Isn't that the story? a heel announcer as the liar or something like
that? Yes. I vaguely remember that. Yeah.
So, I mean, so Joe basically returned back, you know, back home and did stuff, you know, with George All-Star and back to, you know, Channel 69 at that time. And then, you know, we hear this stuff about the, you know, this future Global Wrestling Federation. Like, wow, okay. And they were going to do shows, you know, at Cobb County Civic Center. And like, wow, you know, let's go, we're going to have another national wrestling promotion. And then once you read the newsletters, and Steve Beverling was so good at covering this in Matt Watch. I mean, that's a guy who doesn't get nearly enough credit as well, Steve, for his newsletter work.
Agreed.
Just tremendous.
Agreed.
And he covered this so well. And it was such a bad look for Joe. I felt so bad for him. God. To get hooked in like that. But they did. I mean, Global got off the ground. And boy, was that. Now, were you, Scott, were you announcing on the first tapings?
I guess I was from the first Global tapings when it originated. Yeah, I guess I was there with Craig Johnson. But, I mean, and at that point, we didn't know that it was a work. We didn't know that Joe was being worked by these fraudsters.
Yeah.
And we thought, hey, great, we've got a bottomless pit of money to make this work. Let's do it. Let's give it all we've got. And if you watch the first, oh, wow, I would think the first four or six Global television shows, we were thinking, we've got a bottomless pit of money. We're going to make this work. We're going to compete with WCW and the WWF back then. And then at some point we realized, and it might have been from Joe, it might have been from Bill Levy or Ray Stevens or whoever was working in the front office back then, that, yeah, hey, this is a work. This isn't going to make it. Let's just get everything we can out of this and then move on to the next gig. But hey, if you watch the first Global show, I would say the first month and a half, we thought it was legit. We thought we were gonna, you know, we had enough backing to challenge the big guys.
Yeah, I mean, there was a lot of big names brought in. The Cornette was there. Stan Lane was there. Buddy Landell was there, even though Buddy was, you know,
Muckin' Sing.
Cactus came in.
Riff Rogers.
Jack. Yeah. I mean, that, and of course there was your Texas crew that was there too, like always, like Irwin and Sweet Daddy Falcone and, you know, the guys like that.
Frogman LeBlanc.
There's that name again.
And of course, Bill Eady working as, you know, Axis the Demolisher. And, I mean, Terry Taylor even worked, I think, a Global taping, if I'm not right.
That's correct.
So,
yes.
I mean, there were guys that were coming
and
in and out.
Boys, yep.
And it was a different deal to watch. But the thing is the television that you see on ESPN Classic, it's like a different version than what you saw on syndication. And I want to get your guys' thoughts on this. Was it just – if I'm correct here, was it that like on ESPN, the edict was that if there was some type of violence, you have to show the crowd shot, you couldn't show the violence, but syndication, you could?
That's pretty close. You had to watch the, you know, what we showed on ESPN, but I don't know that it would be as easily as categorized as violence. It was just... Oh God, what am I thinking? The guy that was in WCW, God, it's driving me nuts. From TBS we had one guy that was at every TV that would watch for Standards and Practices.
There you go.
Standards and Practices. We had a guy from Standards and Practices at ESPN that would be at the editing suite. And nope, you can't show that. You can show that. You can't show that. You can show that. You can't show that. And that's what would happen. And the same thing happened with a lot more leeway in WCW, but this was 90 and 91 on ESPN, and S&P was a lot more stringent. But pretty much you're right.
Yeah, it's just so weird to watch, you know, that as a heel's about to start, you know, hitting somebody with maybe a foreign object, a chair or something, and you get this long crowd shot. And it's just like, why? You know, it doesn't make any sense. And but I will say this though about you two guys, you and John. The most insider wrestling commentary I think ever on wrestling television, like on mainstream. I'm not counting indie shows, but it seemed like a running competition between you guys to get, you know, who was going to get the best lines in Matt Walsh. Is that accurate to say?
Oh my God, that is so exactly right. But and that is due to three people, Joe Pedicino, who told us he didn't care as long as we got the product over. Craig Johnson, who, when he heard number one, worked incredibly hard at making sure we knew everything about every guy. And Steve Beverly, who would put us over when we would mention stuff that in 2016, you're thinking like, who cares about that shit? But in 1991, it was cutting edge. That and those three guys, for however Global got over, it was because of Joe and John and Steve Beverly.
Yes. And you know, the thing about the Global was is you guys always talked about the other promotions, which,
right,
you know, NWA did in 1989, you know, when Gordon did the Wrestling News Network and stuff like that. And Joe, you know, I'm talking about on Joe Pedicino Knows. But it wasn't, that was taboo. You didn't do that back then. And it was just definitely cutting edge for his time. And of course, when Eddie got on board as a booker, I mean, Eddie was the first guy to really, at the time period, and this has been talked about. I've heard Doug talk about this on interviews lately about how Eddie would get in these news groups, you know, back when they were like the only thing that was going on this new thing called the internet. And he would, you know, get on there anonymously and find out what everybody was saying and what they were wanting and was trying to book around the internet. This is 1991, 92.
True. That's exactly right. I mean, whenever I get a podcast about the Hall of Fames and the greatest of all time, and I always mention Eddie, and I get a lot of, oh, God, he was so short.
Oh, God, please.
He was in good shape, but he wasn't the greatest worker. And I'm like, you have no idea what Eddie Gilbert would have made to professional wrestling had he survived to 2016. Oh, yes. And that's just another, that's reason, you know, 24C, that Eddie Gilbert would be running this business if he were still alive today.
Yes, Eddie Gilbert was so far ahead of his time. It's insane as far as in work, promos, booking. He was like a wunderkind, and not Alex Wright either. But, you know, it was something to watch him do the stuff he was doing. And it just sucked that Global, you know, had their issues. And Eddie was also his issues. That was a big problem as well. And he couldn't really stay one place for a long period of time for whatever reasons. And this, you know, what happened. But also at this time, you know, you guys are still doing Global. You know, you're still around in Georgia All-Star. And there's a combination show that I remember well from September 15th, 1991 at the Cobb County Civic Center, which featured a match between the Blue Blazer and Stephen the Truth.
Oh,
and
God.
Steve, this is this match is well known among people in the internet, you know, community, the sheet community that knew about this stuff in that era. But you got to talk about the whole genesis of this match.
The genesis was because I live for lousy puns. Nothing gets me going more than really, really bad puns, which was often the catalyst and the inspiration behind so many of the point counterpoint segments that Scott and I did, which got him more and more elaborate, and we started staging these little skits for something that should have just been like us arguing to and fro, but no, we had to get props and costumes and smoke and mirrors and whatever. Anyway, it got to the point where there's a joke that I've always would make joke about the Blue Blazer being, being a little more, than a jacket. And I thought about, I would actually challenge a list of wrestlers that Scott would propose for a match at the Cobb County Civic Center. Well, I would wrestle the Blue Blazer, knowing full well that Owen Hart was probably not going to be coming to the Cobb Civic Center that evening. he probably was not on his agenda. Anyway, so we got to, we had a lot of to and fro, a lot of weeks and weeks of bringing this up, and yes, so we had the match was scheduled where if I didn't defeat the Blue Blazer in less than a minute, I would vacate my job at co-host of Superstars of Wrestling or whatever the show was called that week. Anyway, so I go to the ring and I get my The Truth Hurts tank top. And I'm ready to go. And here comes one of the heel valets and brings the Blue Blazer on a hanger into the ring and, of course, throws it towards me. And, of course, I take a bump for the Blue Blazer. But then again, I pick up the Blue Blazer and then ready for my offense here. And the first thing, of course, because of my love of puns, I immediately yell out loud, "Collar and elbow!" The crowd goes, And of course, I hold it up and then give it a forearm and go, "Clothesline!" Crowd going, and then of course, I have to pin the jacket. And John Horton, who was special guest referee at the time, I don't know why I agree to that part, refused to actually make the count. So I actually had to put his hand down for the third time because after he put his hand down for the second time, he was getting ready to walk out again, and I put the hand down. So I successfully defeated a garment. Anyway, this whole thing lasted for under a minute, really. And the toughest part of the evening was by far trying to convince the evening's booker, who was Bill Eadie, that I wouldn't think up the joints too bad. he was, mind you, Bill is a perpetually cool guy. I mean, he was looking at me like, are we really going to expose the business in the 60 seconds here? So, this thing is going to be over so damn quick, it's going to put a park in your hair. I promise you, Bill, it'll be over really, really, really fast. So, anyway, it was over with, and I think within like, 15 seconds it was forgotten until you brought it up again, Chris. So thank you.
Oh, man, yeah. I got asked about this match. I got a buddy of mine, my co-host in Between the Sheets, David Bixenspan, who just constantly brings this up. He's wanted to, to see this whole deal, the Blue Blazer versus Stephen the Truth. And he asked me, "So what do you remember about that? What do you remember about that?" I trying to tell him what I remember, but I'm so glad that you told the story in the show. And I have forgot that John Horton was the referee. That's the part I forgot about.
Yes. And interestingly, because we plugged it so heavily. We put so heavily on TV. It was absurd. And it wasn't even taped. The match wasn't even taped. Which, mind you, I'm rather happy about it because it's pretty embarrassing for all intents and purposes. But the fact that we were initially going to have this match on television, on the set of Superstars of Wrestling, because it wouldn't have done any damage really. I would think me on top of a sports jacket. But Joe Pettitino said, "No, let's put it in the Cobb Civic Center in front of paying adults." I go, "Oh, God. that's like a really, really bad idea." "No, it'll go over great." Okay.
I think it would have worked better in the auction barn. I think it would have definitely been better there.
Wow.
It belonged to the barn, I'll tell you that. Yeah.
I mean, you could have got the Blue Blazer to fire up and get heat, and the fans would have started chanting for the Blue Blazer. Think about that. I mean, yeah.
However, I do have an opinion of authority that evening the Blue Blazer was on the starch. So I do have an opinion. Thank you. Take your wager.
But that show was an interesting show. I mean, I got to go over the matches real quick because this is your perfect combination show between an indie promotion and a third promotion, I guess you could say. Terry Leland defeated Festus in your opening match. Billy Good. Black and Joel Ooh, Billy God. Black and Joel Deaton defeated Rick Donovan and Chick Donovan. Then we had the Renegade.
Thank God.
The Renegade Warriors battling the Royal Family to a double disqualification. Then we had Scott Anthony, of course, Raven, Scott Levy, over Al Perez. Yeah, Lightning Kid over Chaz.
Good.
Junior heavyweight title match, global junior title. Then you had the Blue Blazer epic. Then you had the Blazers, Ray Lloyd, and Artie Swain going over. Oh, this is a great throwback. Brute Force, Slammer and Jammer.
Whoa, wait a minute. Well, Brute Force is Brute Force, of course, of course. And no one can top Brute Force, of course, unless, of course, that is, of course, unless, of course.
Thank you. I can't believe you actually recall the commentary from back then.
Yeah, Brute Force, wow. And then you have the Handsome Stranger, Bagwell, over Steve the Brawler, sure. Hauler by DQ.
That literally, and I can't speak for Steve, but two of my all-time favorite guys from Georgia All-Star, Mark Bagwell and Steve Lawler, just showed up at every show, busted their ass every night, worked hard, had a great attitude, just solid. Yeah. And whatever happened to Mark or Steve later on, not my business, but God, during that time, perfect.
Mark Bagwell, who's now working as an male escort. If you guys didn't know,
I'll let Steve answer that.
I can't say I didn't know. I've been keeping me tabs on Mr. Bagwell.
He's following the footsteps of Scott Casey.
Anything to keep the bills paid, I guess. But,
he's following the footsteps of Scott Casey.
No, hang on, Chris. I will verify that Steve Lawler is not working as a male escort.
Oh, God.
That would have to be one of the worst interviews ever. I do feel like Steve Lawler. Steve Lawler is actually one of the greatest interviews.
No, Steve Lawler
ever.
Was awesome.
I tell you, because
absolutely.
Getting interviews back
yes.
in the days with Georgia All Star and Southern Championship Wrestling and Pro Wrestling This Week, I'd be one of the guys who would try to get interviews out of these guys, and we would try as best to get. And most of these folks, you know, are Georgia born, Georgia bred, and when they died, as I'm
right,
Georgia
dead,
as Garth Armstrong would always say. And again, a lot of these guys, you know, the accents are really thick, and it's kind of hard. Mind you, now if the signal is not going out too much further out of Atlanta, but still, you want to get like a reasonable interview out of these guys, and I'm afraid that was just not going to be for so many of them, and much as we tried. But Steve Lawler, man, God bless him, he had a pretty convincing Southern draw. But boy, he was like Arn Anderson on proverbial steroids. Just incredible, great, great interviews. It was always a treat whenever I had a chance to get an interview.
I
with
love
Steve
Lawler.
Always was.
Oh yeah.
Amen.
His
Amen.
Work with John Michaels, his Bad Company, anything he did in the Southern Championship Wrestling or Georgia All Star, whatever. Yeah, Steve Lawler was awesome. Back to the show. Terry Gordy defeated Axis the Demolisher. We had, oh, this is a great match. Ooh. Bambi over Lady X by disqualification. Lady X, what was that even? You guys remember?
It wouldn't have been Peggy Lee Leather for the...
yes, it was.
That's a 99% positive guess. If it's Bambi versus... whatever name, it's Peggy Lee Leather. And I love Bambi, love Peggy, but yeah, it was Peggy.
Then we had this classic North American tag title match. Chris Walker, Conan, Mr. Wrestling Tucson.
Oh, boy.
And Steve Simpson
sure.
over Rod Price and John Tatum. And your main event, The Patriot over Stan Lane, North American title match. Fun show.
That's a long night. What a long night that is.
It's almost like a center stage taping.
Hey, wait a second. Wasn't that the night that Sam Kent delivered the Sammy line? That night?
Yes.
He debuted and I believe retired the Sammy line in one night. the Sam Kent clothesline. It was so remarkably bad. It was one of the first recorded gifts in internet history. The Sammy line on
debuted
on
and retired. The same move and the same night. That is perfect.
Another credit to Uncle Sammy right there. He is a.
Oh my God.
But, oh God. 1991. You know, Scott, you left Global in 1991, right? When you left?
Well, actually, Global left me. They had no more funds to pay for transportation. They never paid me anything, but just they paid me to go out there to Dallas to the sportatorium, and then they said, we can't pay you to go out there anymore. Like, well, I'm not going to pay to go do TV, and that was it.
Yeah, and I remember it was reported in Matt Watch that your real life job was taking a toll on you as well, or something like that, and just having to go to Dallas back and forth so much.
Well, not really. They at that time I was working for the state of Georgia, and then I transitioned to the federal government, but they were all like, you're doing wrestling? Oh, cool. Do what you need to do. But then when I'm like, well, I'm not going to lose money doing it, so no, I'm not going. And that was the end of it.
And then you were replaced by Bruce Pritchard, if I'm not mistaken. And, of course, you know, they did the whole deal where Bruce Pritchard, of course, would become the genius or whatever it was.
Right. He was the genius. That's exactly right.
Move on real quick with Global. We talked about this guy the other day on Between the Sheets, and he's come up a lot. Max Andrews. What was the real deal with Max Andrews? I mean, we know he was a syndication guy, but it seems like he had his hand in stuff more than that.
Well, if when it comes to Max, think about Max as let's see, maybe Bill Watts in WCW when he was running the company. All he was doing was running the company, but he made himself the titular head of everything that happened. That was Max. Max was the syndicator of Global and everything that was left of USWA and World Class even back then. But that was Max. He wasn't anything other than the guy that was putting up the money to get the TV around a million markets.
Yeah. He's just a name that's always come up in different things over the years, because he was involved in a deal with David Woods, where he was trying to buy David Woods' syndicated stuff. I think eventually did. Him and Jerry Jarrett had their ups and downs. That's a guy who I think, if he wrote a book, it would be an interesting book, all his dealings.
Well, now, see, I'm going to tell you this, Chris, and I don't know if Max is still alive, even, but Max was a great businessman. He was. If I were going to open up a Quick Trip or, you know, a Facebook franchise or from one extreme to the other in business, I would trust Max. When it comes to wrestling, I would rather bring in Ronnie Gossett. Not Ronnie P. Gossett, but Ronnie Gossett.
Do you know what Max does now?
Okay. I do not.
Max Andrews, I don't know if it was in the 90s or in the 2000s, got involved with these golf travel shows that's on syndicated sports networks. And he pitches those shows. So basically what he does is, you know, he just goes around the world and films golf shows to syndicate on sports networks. What a job he's got, huh?
Well, it's kind of like what the guys that killed WCW, like Jamie Kellner, did, where now they're doing gospel music television. Good luck with that.
Jamie Kellner. Steve, what were your thoughts about the Sportatorium the first time you went in there?
I've never ever set foot in the Sportatorium.
So Steve and the Truth
never ever been in the Sportatorium.
So Steve and the Truth never appeared at the Sportatorium.
No, actually, all the counterpoints I did for Global were all taped here in Atlanta. I never set foot in. Actually, I don't believe the Global Dome. I think you're a part of it. It's not the Sportatorium.
Right.
It's the Global Dome, and it's
it is in
an unnamed city somewhere. I think it's near where the Simpsons and Springfield were.
Yeah,
I think it's somewhere up there.
Right.
Like that. I've only been in the Dallas airport once, you know, changing planes, but I've never ever set foot in the sportatorium. And if I did, I probably would have to wipe my shoes.
Okay, I'll take the question to Scott then. I mean, we saw the sportatorium for years on television, and you hear the stories about the place, and what did you think about it?
I got to tell you that when the first time I stepped foot in the sportatorium, after years and years of watching, you know, the Freebirds and the Von Erichs and everything underneath, it was quite underwhelming. I walked into that place like, this is basically a covered urinal, a covered communal urinal. But and as I talked to Kevin Von Erich and Gary Young and Eric Embry and all the guys that worked in Global that were in WCCW, they were like, "Yeah, that's what makes it great. It's basically an indoor urinal." Any questions? Like, okay, super, I'll be back next week. As you think back on the great venues of all time, like the Spectrum or Reunion Arena or Madison Square Garden or God, the one in Frisco, help me out,
the Omni
Cow Palace in San Francisco, or the Omni in Atlanta. It was just another venue, and as we sit here in 2016, it wasn't that great. It was the legends and the stories and the legendary stories, as it were, from those venues that made it seem so much more than it was. And as I look at the footage of Kevin walking through what's left of the sportatorium before it was torn down, it's sad, but at the end of the day, it's like it needed to be torn down, because if it were still around today, it would just be a hollow shell of what it was back in the day. And Steve will tell you this, when I got married to my beautiful, darling wife, Casey, we had Steve's wife take photos of our wedding. But other than that, there are no photos of our wedding. And at that point, we were like, well, if you want to take pictures, but nobody bought a camera except Steve's wife. So now it's basically what you remember our wedding to be.
Yeah.
And it's sort of the same thing about the sportatorium. There aren't many pictures. There's the video of the TV, and that's supposed to look good, like Steve's wife's photos of our wedding look like, God, you know, out of a magazine. They're so perfect, but everybody else's memories, yeah, that's what I remember. I remember it looking just like Mary's pictures. I remember it looking just like the world-class TV. It didn't, because that was somebody that knew what they were doing, memorializing those images. And as we sit here in 2016, we're like, wow, if it only looked as good as somebody that knew what they were doing memorialized, like Steve's wife with our wedding, or Keith Mitchell and the rest of that bunch with World Class, it almost takes away from it to remember exactly how it really wasn't that great. It was just how good they made it look. And it's better to have those memories than the reality of it.
Yeah, exactly. So, like I said, you got out earlier. And John and Joe stayed for a little bit longer. Global, it started changing more and more. And then once they left, I mean, it became a complete joke. But what was John and Joe going through there at the end that you remember, Scott, about, you know, when they finally decided the time is up to go?
Okay, write this down. M-O-M-E-Y.
Hey, it talks.
It's money. And Steve and I are over here in Atlanta, and Mark and Dell and Scotty and everybody else over here in Atlanta, when they couldn't afford to bring us out to Dallas every week for television, they said, I tell you what, as of this bright red line, we now become basically a Texas promotion. Well, then you got Rattlesnake Rates, mm-hmm. and Gary Young
Johnny
and God
Mantel.
Knows who else. Johnny,
exactly. Tug Taylor.
Hey, Jesus Christ, I'll just step out if it's okay with you all. But yeah, that's them. When those guys started getting pushed to the top, that's what happened. They couldn't afford to bring in the talent from the Southeast and the East Coast, like Steve and I and Dell and Scotty and Mark and even Cactus and Terry Gordy and everybody else. They were like, well, we're going to make this a Texas-based promotion. Well, that died once, and it died again.
Yeah. And then once you have David Webb taking over, and then you're doing bungee matches,
oof,
and
oof.
I mean, it just became a complete clusterfuck of a show.
Oh, and
well, now in all honesty, that was all Steve Prazak when he was in charge of the booking committee. That was all him.
Oh. That's probably why I was booking from my toilet. That's probably why it.
Mike Davis, yeah, Mike Davis with his moon rock. I mean, oh. It's just an embarrassment.
and Sebastian.
Sebastian.
Oh, my Lord.
Global went down so hard.
Kayfabe. Jesus Christ.
Global went down so hard, so fast. The two names you brought up, though, and talking about that quick going over there, Del Wilkes and Scott Levy. Del Wilkes, I mean, the guy was on AWA television as the Trooper, but when he took that Patriot gimmick, he was a star. He was a real star.
Yeah.
Probably Global's only real homemade star.
Correct. Let me break kayfabe with you, Chris, for just a half a second. Personal demons.
No.
I mean, is that that's not a tag team that worked the indies out in California.
Yeah.
That's a real thing. And he won't deny it.
He hasn't.
And a lot of the guys won't deny it, that it brought a lot of fantastic talent, and he being one of them. And I'm glad to say that in 2016, he is still with us, and he is 100% in conquest of his personal demons and is back 100% in good shape. But back then, yeah, he could have been a big deal. He could have been the next Hogan, the next Flair. He could have been there because he had the look, he had the promo skills, he had everything he needed. But, those personal demons, as it were, he couldn't get past
them. Yeah, he did a couple of shows on a Terry Garvin Sins podcast that's really good if you guys never heard it. And he's been very, very open about his problems, and you're definitely right. He has definitely conquered them. But a guy who also had his problems too, those demons, was Scott Levy, and the Scotty Anthony character, Scotty Flamingo character. If people just remember the Raven gimmick, they're doing a disservice, because Scott Levy and any incarnation of that character, Scotty the Body or whatever, fantastic. God, what a funny guy.
Yeah. Absolutely. When Scotty and I did an old show called The Monday Night Mayhem back for the last half of the 20 months, and I mentioned Scotty when he was on the show one night. I said that he is the Madonna of professional wrestling, in that as the culture would change, as the genre would change, he would change with it. He wouldn't try to direct. He would follow the fans instead of trying to force the fans to follow him. And I remember that Scotty, when we did that interview that night, this was 5 or 6 years ago, that he thought that was the ultimate compliment, because that's what he was trying to do. He wasn't trying to redirect the business. He was following the direction the business was going. And he did that. He did that every time he tried. And he had a run of, when you think about it, Scotty was around for 25 years before he finally caught up with him. But he did fantastic. He made a lot of money. He did a great job. I hope and I think I know that he saved a lot of his money. He just did fantastic. And Scott would let the business direct him instead of trying to direct the business. And that's a huge difference. And Scott was very smart in that regard.
Yes. People really need to go check him out in that role, in that character. Because, I mean, he was so good. I mean, it was quintessential early 90s pop culture. I mean, you had to live it to understand it. And you're perfectly right with how he changed. Because he went from being, you know, Johnny Polo in WWF to, you know, taking that Raven character. Yeah. And he made it, you know, a quintessential character of his era in wrestling. So, you know, props to him.
Right.
Now, all right, Global, everybody's gone from Global now, and now you guys have a lot of free time on your hands. So, the Shinomaki Post is born. And I know that you guys were definitely inspired by Pro Wrestling Sushi. So, you got to talk about that real quick. How influential was Pro Wrestling Sushi on Shinomaki Post?
Pretty much. It was an inspiration behind it. The combination of Scott, John Horton, and myself. Well, we had this sort of whirlwind thing going on constantly. So there was no real genesis from where a lot of these ideas all came from, because we were constantly throwing all these things up in the air all the time. But the fact that Sushi was like really, really, really funny.
Jeff Mullins.
Was he the one who was Tux Newman in Memphis? Wasn't he Tux Newman for didn't he also do a
Jeff Wall? Yes, Jeff
manager,
Wall.
Mullen? Oh, okay. I got my Jeff.
Yeah.
Okay, but I remember loving Sushi up. Was a lot of fun. But we wanted to turn Shinomaki Post into sort of more of a mad magazine for pro wrestling, where they would always do takeoffs on movies by putting the Alfred E. Newman character in it. And we did it, you know, by turning it up taking a popular movie at the time, say Sleepless in Seattle, and turning it into the whole Eric Bischoff thing, calling it Aimless in Atlanta, you know, and designing like a movie poster with all these people, and some of whom would have no real place in there, you know. So I'll throw Milton Berle in there, or so whatever the hell it was, just for no damn reason whatsoever, and you know, and soundtrack by Marple Hayes and the Hillbilly Peppers, you know, all kinds of things that I was, you know, all these wild things that I was bouncing off my head, you know, throwing it in there. So it was just kind of just a wild little product of ours, Scott and John and my imagination. And but again, I think Mad Magazine is actually more of the inspiration behind that than anything else, really. And then we only did that for about a year and a month, I think. It took a lot of our time, and more than you realize. And I think we just kind of got a little bit withered out by it. And then now every time that Scott and I find something funny or whatever, the first thing that comes out of our mind, we need to get a January issue together. Which is if we've ever actually assembled the proverbial January issue with all the things we've always threatened to put it in there, it would be quite a lengthy tome at this stage in the game. But anyway, that was our Shinomaki Post lasted for all of 1993 and I think 1 month into 1994.
And you said Mad Magazine. I think it's more of a cross between Mad Magazine and National Lampoon in a lot of ways.
Could all be.
I mean, it was hilarious. I mean, some of the funniest stuff that you would see. And it was so different because, you know, most of your wrestling newsletters at the time, you know, like The Torch and The Observer and whatever else is around, all, you know, basically serious, although Dave, you know, we'd have his lines in there, but a lot of seriousness. And this is just all straight up comedy. You're running jokes. Of course, Chick Donovan, which, Scott, I mean, you guys made Chick Donovan into like a, you know, a local cult hero among Chick Donovan's legendary.
Well, keep in mind,
a cult hero. I can't quite envision that exactly. I'm not quite sure why we latched on to Chick Donovan, other than the fact that I have a propensity to want to keep flogging a dead horse, and I guess Chick Donovan was my dead horse, but. for some reason. I mean, again, every Chick Donovan joke in there was an old Milton Berle joke from Vaudeville. There was nothing really new about any of those jokes, but I had so many of them, and I think I used them all. I think I used every damn one of them.
Well, and I got to tell you, in all honesty, saying that we made Chick Donovan a cult hero is like saying Shakespeare made Julius Caesar a cult hero. I mean, my God, the legend was born long before we put pen to paper with that man. And the thing is, Chick Donovan was not a bad worker. He was actually a great hand. Now when Memphis and world class, he would get pushed up, you know, from the bottom of the card to the middle of the card, and that was okay. But he was like the earliest incarnation of Tex Slazenger. We're like, here's a guy who's getting buried. Why? He looks like $1 million. He can't cut a promo to save his life, but my God, he looks like $1 million. Let's put him over. And off we go. And Chick Donovan became the legend he is today, honestly, because
it still works.
Of Steve and John and I, and that's right, he's still working at the age of 87. I'm sorry, 687.
And he still looks almost exactly the same.
He does, my God.
Well, I think the years are beginning to come up with him. I think he's actually, I think I was talking to a couple of people who've worked with him in recent months, and they've noticed that he's beginning to get a little showing his age a little bit more as pronounced as it is. But I guess, you know, when you work so hard in that NWA championship match against Abe Lincoln, you know, of course it's gonna pay its toll there on the
Farmer
body.
Burns called him a wild veteran. That's what I heard. So, but Chick was one. Rip Rogers is another guy who.
He's fantastic.
Rip, you talk about a guy, he just turned, I think, 61, and I follow Rip on Twitter, and Rip is still, like, jacked up. I mean, he's another guy that looks good for his age.
I believe that. Great guy. Fantastic guy.
He's hilarious, too. The ongoing bits that he does with Honky Tonk Man, Wayne Ferris, about Robert Fuller's dick, it's one of the funniest things on Twitter.
Wow.
Hey, I'm sorry I missed it.
That has WrestleMania 32 main event written all over it, if I've ever heard it. Oh, my God.
Between those two and Missy Hyatt, Robert Fuller's dick has become, you know, a running joke online. Missy Hyatt talks about a lot. Missy Hyatt just did a shot this weekend for AIW in Ohio, where Robert was there in the Colonel Parker gimmick, managing Bunkhouse Buck, managing Jimmy Golden in a match now, where Tracy Smothers was involved and all sort of stuff. And Missy gave Robert a nut shot with a bull rope. and the joke was that if it tied it.
It's a wonder she didn't give him a nut shot with a roll of like $100 bills.
And the joke was they pulled the knots out of the rope.
My God.
But yeah,
I sure hope he wasn't eating any bird seed. Wasn't that?
And that's another guy that looks great for his age. And Robert's put in his late 60s, maybe 70. Now he looks good.
Yeah.
But,
he's gonna be up there. Yeah.
There's so many like running jokes. Of course, Tex is spotlighted in there. The Bombastic Booker. Now, I always heard that was supposed to be Bill Watts, like your guy's spoof of Bill Watts. But I mean, was that true, or was that just a character, just a general character?
That was always Horton's, and I'll defer to Steve for a different take. But I think Bombastic Booker was John.
I don't even remember Bombastic Booker. Are you sure that was
from the Shinawaki Post? He would write as the Bombastic Booker.
Yeah, it's him.
And make these crazy booking decisions.
Yeah, I guess I guess what happened. I was too worried about my Chick Donovan classifies to deal who the Bombastic Booker was. But I don't know.
Another one of my favorite was the Bubba Wrestling Federation.
that's still promoting in the southern half of Alabama. Yeah, they're drawing good money.
The Tommy Rich.
Wasn't that the one where Tommy Rich was booking, where he and everybody was named Bubba, like Paulus Bulba?
All right, I'll run down the list. All right, we have Tommy Rich as Giant Bubba.
Sure.
That's funny. Bubba, Million Dollar Bubba, Nature Bubba, Ric Flair,
yep.
The Nasty Bubbas, Mongolian Bubba Stomper, rest in peace, The Ultimate Bubba, The Legion of Bubba, Beautiful Bubba, a pair of identical twins who go in the name of Dubba Bubba, The Dirty White Bubbas,
good.
Macho Bubba, Flying Bubba, Abdullah the Bubba, Cow Bubba Bill Watts, Bubba Brazil, the Heavenly Bubbas, the Bubba Machine, Lover Bubba Dennis Condry, Mondo Bubba, the Bubbarian, which is my favorite, Downtown Bubba, the Raging Bubba, Jesse
sure.
the Bubba, Bubba Flamingo, formerly Scotty the Bubba, Jushin Thunder Bubba, and your top baby face, Ricky Steam Bubba. And each wrestler must use Achy Breaky Heart as their interest music.
Wow. How can that not draw money? My God.
Well, that was pretty good. That was pretty
yeah.
good. I do recall our brainstorming for that event.
I mean, it's just this stuff was at the time was just so fucking hilarious. I mean, it was so different to look at. It was a much needed comic relief for what was going on, because wrestling in this time period was. Really, it was about to start its downward slide in a lot of ways, and it needed levity. You needed some levity type stuff, and you guys provided a lot of great stuff, man. Oh, oh my God! And you guys did like your version of the Matt Watch lines you would like to see. which was hilarious stuff. In fact, you know, the one that you did on David Webb was Elvis has finally left the building. It's permanently barred from ringside. Oh, man. It's funny stuff. But, yeah, so the post ran at 94. So, I mean, you guys were basically.
Yeah.
I mean, how long was it before, Scott, you went up in WCW?
That would have been December 95 when they called me and brought me in for the audition, and off I went in January 96.
Now, were you brought in basically to replace Chris Cruz?
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, I hate to think about it that way because he was fantastic.
Yeah.
And to this day, I love his commissary. I don't know what happened, if he wanted to do something else or if they couldn't work out a contract agreement. Of course, I was used to working, as Steve will attest, for $5 a month. They said, we'll double that. So I'm in. And off we went.
It's funny how you ended up working in WCW after all those years of giving their front office complete hell.
Not only the front office, but the ring announcer, Rhubarb
Jones.
Oh,
the legend.
Which, as we sit here in 2016, my daughter, who is just the most wonderful kid on earth, will every now and then will walk downstairs in my house here on the lake and just say, Rhubarb, just hark! Out of nowhere. I'll have to remind myself, oh, yeah, that was the game that we pulled the center stage. And it works all the time.
You know he's now Dr. Rhubarb Jones, right? You didn't know that. He has a doctorate degree. Yeah,
really?
You know what,
I did not know that.
Yeah, he teaches communications at Kennesaw State now. Yeah.
Good for him.
I
had zero problem with Rhubarb as a human being. But as somebody who would be the first to walk out in those awful PN News TV tapings I mean, he was going to be the first person to absolutely cut off at the knees and at the ball sack. Just because he was the first person to walk
out. Another Rhubarb Jones related story during those long, long center stage tapings. The way that referees knew that the match was supposed to end, they would look at Rhubarb, and Rhubarb would put a pen in his mouth to indicate to go to the finish. And we all picked up on that. And when matches started getting really bad, the entire row of Atlanta boys would all stick pens in their mouth and like stand up and like wave our little heads up in the camera. But for some reason, they never really never picked up on. Anyway, for a while, they kept changing the sign from the pen in the mouth to other things. But the whole row of people with pen in their mouths was a very distinctive thing.
That is exactly right. The minute we picked up on whatever Rhubarb was working to give the ref the golfing sign, we would triple down on it. If it was a pin in the mouth, we had 700 pins in the crowd that we would pass out.
And if we weren't putting pens in our mouth, as soon as we saw Rhubarb put the pens in the mouth, the entire row would erupt in applause. The end was mercifully coming up soon.
Well, that's it for the Johnny Gunn match.
God.
Let's move on.
Or Tom Brady, or Salvatore Sinceri, or Doink the Clown, or the Page,
yes.
Whoever he's working as these days.
Big Josh. No, Big Josh.
Oh, man. And for those of you who don't know who Rhubarb Jones was, Rhubarb was the number one country music DJ in Atlanta. And he first got involved in wrestling with Joe. He was Joe's sidekick on Southern Championship Wrestling with Jerry Blackwood.
That's correct.
And then when NWA formed up and started going to center stage, Rhubarb was the guy they brought in to be a ring announcer. And, because they wouldn't fly Capetta in a whole lot. That changed later on, but it was Rhubarb or Tony Gillum. Oh, God, that's a blast in the past. And, guys like that would be the ring announcers. But Tony Gillum.
Let me tell you a quick story, Chris, and see if you let me up on this. Tony Gillum was so over with us that we did a, like, it, remember back in the early 90s, you could get a poster board at the drugstore or at the Publix or whatever, and we would get a poster board and get one of those, like, big, oh, help me out, Steve. What was it called? Like a...
Oak tag.
I'm sorry?
Tag.
Yeah, like the thing you would get in, like a three-hole punch notebook, but you could get just one circle of it, and we would have that to where we could change... it could flip over the name of the thing. We would have Tony Gillum at the bottom, and we would have like these interchangeable titles for Tony at center stage. It was like the Tony, the total package, Tony Gillum, the Nature Boy, Tony Gillum. And we were just like all show long. We're holding up the sign and say, the Nature Boy, Tony Gillum. And then the next match, the total package, Tony Gillum. The Dragon, Tony Gillum, and he's looking, and then the sad thing is, and I'll defer to Steve on this, is I think we cost him his job, because he was so over, they were like, we can't have our fucking ring announcer be more over than Big Josh, it must be the ring announcer's fault, get rid of him.
The problem was, I don't think we really elongated anybody's career in WCW back in the early 90s.
Yeah, we controlled everything, basically.
Yeah, I get the impression that if we liked you back then, you're toast.
So that's what happened to the Cole twins.
Oh, I tell you, the Cole twins turned things around remarkably. In WCW, they were milquetoast. But when I joined NWA Wildside in 98...
Yeah.
They were fantastic. I don't know what happened between WCW and NWA Wildside, but boy, they were really good. Really good. Really fun matches to call, and the quality of wrestling went skyrocketing. I guess maybe that, I don't know if they were hands were tied in WCW or whatever, but when they were taken out of that environment and up at Wildside, I'll tell you, mind you, the quality of wrestling at Wildside was really good. Really,
amen.
So that helped a lot there too, but definitely the Coles had it going on eventually.
Yeah.
But for a while there, yeah, they were this source of much derision out of my
Did you guys ever go to any of the Crystal Chandelier shows in Kennesaw?
I did not. No, I never went to any.
I did not. No.
Yeah, because that was kind of ahead of its time too, because those were basically student shows. And it was for the shows for the power plant guys. And the Cold Twins were like main eventers on those shows. And they would work against guys like Michael Hayes and Terry Taylor, and like the veterans, and it was training and stuff like that. And they only did it for a very short amount of time.
Because I remember because Wildside was WCW's farm team, farm league for a while. So we had like Bob Sapp for about 2 months. He was terrible, but he cut quite a figure out of my tongue. Especially seeing him in a priest suit. Boy, I tell you, that scared the living bejesus out of me.
Yeah.
Bob Sapp wearing a dress as a priest. And a lot of the power plant guys were they were in the first four matches every week at Wildside. And some of those guys are pretty good.
To give you a hint of what those Crystal Chandelier shows were like, here's one from October 93. All right. Bryant Anderson defeated the Gambler. Then you had Terry Taylor went over the Ace, who I guess was Gambler's tag partner. I don't know who that was. Michael Hayes over Hard Work Bobby Walker. The Equalizer over Mike Winter. Thunder and Lightning over Buddy Lee Parker and Big Bad John. And your main event, Tex and Shanghai over Tom Zink and Jungle Jim Steele.
Good grief.
So that's the type of shows that they're running at Crystal Chandelier, which was a nightclub Kennesaw in that area. So, they didn't run them long. But, yeah, they were like the first version of student shows, that, you know, of a major promotion for the power plant. But, you know, you go to WCW, Scott, in 95, and, you know, right as they're about to start exploding, and you were there for the NWO and all that stuff. Big Show. We're taping this on Tuesday night. Big Show was on Steve Austin's podcast Monday night after Raw. And he was talking about how, you know, Terry Taylor told him in the locker room in 97, he said, man, if you want to be a star, you got to get out of here. You got to go to New York because this place is about to go under. So Terry Taylor knew that in 1997. Did you feel the same way that far in advance or even in that, around that time period, that this place is about to eat itself alive?
I will say that I, with all due respect to Terry, that I hold in the highest regard in 97. No, I wouldn't have thought about that because in 97, we were on the complete upturn. We were arcing up as high as you could. And it was only in late 99, early 2000 that we started to crater. So in 97, no, I would think Terry would have been wrong, but maybe he was prescient. Maybe he knew he could see what was happening. He knew what was going on in the front office.
Yeah, he had an advantage. But, you know, he was seeing what was going on more than you guys were.
Yeah.
You know, but.
Well, actually, I imagine at that time, Terry Taylor was probably seeing how this thing could possibly be going on at this level in years to come. That's probably what imagine he probably couldn't see things going at this level in 5 years time. That's probably the way.
The way Big Show was telling it was that you know Terry was talking about how the politics was starting to really get bad, you know, and like I said, the sharks are going to eat each other alive here, and that's basically what happened. But you know, we get the stories about how television was done, you know, how it was booked during the show and you guys were getting all these different formats. How frustrating was that as an announcer to have all these changes done as you're going in the show?
It was tough because we knew that because we were all, you know, old school fans, we knew that, you know, if we were thinking 5, 6, 7 years ahead, we were dead. We were not going to be able to sustain this. We'd have something different. But the guys booking the show and Eric, God love him, and everybody else, Kevin, that were the booking WCW, we were like, where are we going to be in 5 years, in 6 years? Oh, it doesn't matter. We're good for next week. And, oh, God, that hurt because we need to be booking past next week. And that hurt. We knew that we were going to make it for the long term with that booking mindset.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And, you know, as we're taping this, Georgia and Florida are playing basketball on ESPN. And somebody that's prominently being shown because the way they're, you know, the camera's that on the side is facing is where the media table is Tony Schiavone. Because Tony works for University of Georgia as a producer on the radio network. And, I mean, if you watch the Georgia basketball games, he's right there, right beside the bench, always in a red coat. And Tony seems like the kind of guy who his spirit was killed pretty much. I know Bobby Heenan said the same thing. That WCW basically killed his spirit. I've heard other people involved in that said that. Did WCW affect your wrestling fandom at the time, Scott? What was going on?
Wow, you know, that's a great question. No, it didn't, because as we sit here in 2016, I can go back and pull up YouTube or Vimeo or Dailymotion and watch any old wrestling stuff, and that passion gets reinvigorated immediately. So, no, it didn't kill me. For the time, yeah, it was like, God, this is really not that good. But I go back and watch, you know, the Birds or the Sheik or Kevin in Florida or the King in Memphis or anything like that, and I remember why I loved the business.
Yeah,
I think Tony Giovanni's case. Remember, Tony was the producer of all WCW shows, and Tony was responsible for every week during the height of WCW's popularity. He was in charge. He was producing 3 live hours of Nitro, 2 hours of Thunder. Up to 2 hours of WCW Saturday Night, plus, I believe, up to 6 first-run hours of syndication for domestic and international use, and that's every week.
Yeah,
I could see Tony probably had lots of love for the business by the time WCW ended. I imagine he slept really, really well for a number of months after it was over. That's my guess. In Tony's case, that's quite a remarkable accomplishment. I don't know how he went through all that without getting an ulcer. That's remarkable stuff.
Yeah. Now, when Vince Russo comes in and Ed Ferrara, how did you feel about the way they changed the way everything was run compared to where it was with Eric Bischoff, Kevin Sullivan, etc.? Scott.
Well, we knew the business was changing. We knew that when Vince came in and Ed and Bill Banks, that everything had changed because of the genesis of of what WWE was doing, WWF at the time with the Attitude Era. So we had to adjust and shift and become something better. And we knew at the time that the days of, oh, Arn Anderson is wrestling Bobby Eaton. My God, isn't that incredible? Those days were over. We had to have the Fat Chick Thriller wrestling, Masachono. Those days were where we were going and where we were, and we had to go from there. So we knew. But that's the transition that we couldn't make. And the WWE couldn't make it either. They just survived where we didn't.
Yeah. Now, as all this is going on, Scott, Steve, you're in ECW. What was that like?
Correct, yeah. a lot different than what Scott was going through in WCW. ECW was, of course, I got there and I started in March of 1998. So I wasn't hard to call myself an ECW original, to use the parlance of the time. But I was coming in probably closer to the end of the end than towards the beginning, or the end of the beginning, I would think. My first inclination when I first got there was it was the WrestlePalooza pay-per-view, which was in Marietta, Georgia.
I was there.
it was called, I think our backstage pass had it written on there, on enemy turf. And I think Paul was very Paul was very excited to be doing a key ECW show in WCW territory. But I remember my first indication was walking into the dressing room before the show started. Now, this is before the show started. I walk in there, and of course, we're hit by the overwhelming smell of Bengay all over the place. And you see everybody with their arms all wrapped up in gauze, elevated, sitting on top of tables, on top of their suitcases, on top of chairs. It looked like a mass recovery unit. That's what the backstage area looked like at ECW show. And this was before the show even started.
Yes.
How are these guys going to perform here tonight? But lo and behold, they did. It was just remarkable. And that night, Paul used me for his backstage interview as a backstage interview guy from there to the very last show. I think who was the guy I replaced?
Lance Wright.
Lance Wright. Oh boy, Lance Wright. Well, I've heard some tales about him that I can't repeat here. But anyway, I am happy to replace him. But anyway, it was a lot of fun because I think Paul liked me because I made a lot of big funny faces whenever the guys would talk and help make the guys. He wanted to make the undercard guys, the middle of the card guys, give them a little bit more complexity in their characters, whatever. That was the sole reason I was there.
Yeah.
Although I made a play one time, wanting to be able to do color commentary because I was getting to be pretty good with that. First off, with Scott. And at the time, I was doing it with Dan the Dragon Wilson of Wildside.
Oh, yes.
And he and I became like probably the best commentary team for about a couple of years there. So I really kind of wanted to throw my wild oats there in the ECW in the color commentator role. But Paul was pretty adamant of having Joey to go solo in that department. And I can't complain in that department since Joey did that rather well. But anyway, that ECW time was just a lot of fun. They treated me great. They paid me great. No problems with any checks from other folks. And travel was great. The people were great. And, got along with everybody, save for maybe a couple of them. And there were a couple of memorable backstage times with. I probably shouldn't even go into that kind of thing. But anyway, that's still was there. There was a show in Columbia, South Carolina. They did an ECW show taping there, and Jim Mitchell brought some of his stripper buddies from one of the local shacks, shall we say, and they brought him in and made the backstage added a lot of frivolity to the backstage area that night there too. And the guys still talk about that night a lot.
Jim Mitchell, strippers? Come on.
I wasn't quite aware of the connection at the time, but we found out rather quickly.
That guy. Well, the stories he could tell, man. But you mentioned Wildside. Wildside at one point in time and was probably the best wrestling on any type of television in 2001, 2002.
I agree.
It was so good. Mm-hmm. It's all on YouTube, folks. Everything is on YouTube from that era. If you just look it up, I mean, all the complete episodes from that run, and you can hear Steve and Dan the Dragon Wilson or Scott would come in and do commentary. Our dear friend Al Getz would come in and do commentary. Just so much great stuff going on. And AJ Styles, he just went in WWE, the Royal Rumble, and everybody knows him from Ring of Honor, New Japan, TNA. But Wildside is where he became AJ Styles. And, I mean, there was so much great young talent that was in that promotion, that was coming in and out, whether they were homegrown guys or, coming in from out of the area. It was just a hotbed of wrestling for a good 5 years. Amazing stuff.
Yeah, I mean, remarkable how much they kept it going. And the main reason for that was, in two words, Bill Behrens.
Oh, yes.
Bill Behrens, hands down, is the brightest mind in TV wrestling from 1998 on, probably to this very day, although I'm sure he's rather happy to have washed his hands of TV wrestling in all honesty. He's happy being Agent of the Stars now. But he was just remarkable. As a wrestling promoter, he was terrible. As a guy who puts together wrestling shows, remarkable.
Yes.
Just remarkable. One of the best ever. And he got a chance when Deep South picked him up, and me at the time, actually, to do the WWE Farm League thing there in Stockbridge, Georgia, and until ties were broken there too. And that was a shame too, because he would have had a lot to contribute to that booking environment. Like Barons was something, but Barons is a big reason why NWA Wildside was so damn good for so long, because he knew the talent that he had. I mean, they were all young guys. They were small, really, really small. They're just remarkable. And they did things that nobody else did, and they put together just wonderful matches. And this is a great, great time. And calling that stuff was easily my best work in front of a microphone, with Dan Wilson, and certainly with Scott. Calling wrestling with Scott Hudson, I must admit, is more fun than human beings are allowed to have, but it's kind of tricky calling wrestling with Scott, I found out, because he and I have a tendency to want to say the same thing at the same time.
Yeah.
Which for friends to be like is fantastic. For co-commentators, well, you end up like biting your lip sometimes, and we tend to feed each other lines more often than at that. But going back, my best work was definitely with Wildside, and it was so easy and it was so much fun, and it's just what a great promotion that was.
Yeah,
it was something.
And not just mention AJ Styles, but Caprice Coleman is on Ring of Honor television all the time. And I mean, this is
Cole,
15 years ago. He was great then, you know. Jimmy Rave has had the tremendous comeback. One of the best workers in the world right now. And you go back and watch him then, and you can see that he had the makings then as a 1 year rookie, two year guy in that era.
Yeah,
I mean, just so many great guys that was coming in and out of there, and a good mixture of, you had your veterans too, guys like David Young, Rick Michaels, guys like that, that was working against the younger guys, and and of course Rick was teaching most of those young guys. It's something that people need to go back and watch. I've watched a lot of it last year, about 2001, 2002. It still holds up. I mean, yeah, there's some stuff that's a sign of the times, but it's just so good. And a guy who doesn't get nearly enough credit for his role in that promotion, and still to this day is fantastic at what he does, is Jeff G. Bailey.
Oh yeah. That's he's remarkable. I've never met anybody quite like that. Those promos he utters, they're almost, they come from someplace else.
Yeah.
They're so filled. They're filled with piss and vinegar and death and destruction he brings up all these horrific crimes and disgusting things from years past. I mean, as a being the son of Austrian immigrants from the 30s, hearing Jeff G. Bailey bringing up some scene from Belsen and Auschwitz in his promos, I've never seen somebody who played a manager who was an attorney/agent, and who'd be quite as bloodthirsty as this guy. He's remarkable. And it's funny, towards the end of the NWA Anarchy, I swung by one of the shows there, and I found out that Jeff Bailey was actually a babyface.
Yeah, they turned him down. They turned him babyface,
That can't be. Why didn't we spin through the vortex on that one? How's that entirely possible? But anyway, no, Jeff Bailey was remarkable. And going back to the name you mentioned earlier, Caprice Coleman, that guy should be a superstar. He is just remarkable. Great promos and a style no one touches. He's just remarkable. Someone else doesn't get much credit that he should. Was Rain Man.
Yes.
Who wrestles now under the name Corey Chavis. And he and Rick Michaels together, boy, they put together, there were a couple of matches there among the highlights of my time in the Wildside. But Corey Chavis as Rain Man then was, he was
one of the ultimate guys. What could have been was Jason Cross.
Oh my goodness, yes, he was something else there too.
Jason Cross, who had a lot of stuff outside the ring, and I mean, not problems, but not like drug problems, but problems with family and stuff that would hold him back. I mean, him and AJ Styles were about on the same trajectory, and that could have been one of those fears that could have, they could have took that match as a traveling match to all these different places, and it would have been you know, fantastic. He's a guy just completely gets forgot about. Adam Jacobs, another guy. You know, there's so many great guys that was coming through there. And you talk about Jeff G. Bailey go, you know, become a babyface. The transformation that Dan the Dragon Wilson underwent. You know, you watch him with you, and he's got that early 2000s white boy haircut. You know, the with the frosted tips or whatever, and then he becomes like this dude with long hair, long beard, becoming the leader of the Devil's Rejects, a Satan worshiper gimmick. I mean, it's just, and when Bailey was babyface, at one point he was feuding against Dan. So I mean, it's just the weirdest thing to watch. You know, going back to that stuff. And I love Dan. I've had Dan on the show before. And we're going to do a Wild Side show eventually because we talked about it on a show in the past. And I definitely would love to have you and Dan do a show together in the future about Wild Side. Because there is so much to talk about there. But yeah, I mean, it's Georgia wrestling. I can't think of many things better than that. I'm glad that it's gone through a renaissance in the last year or two. So many groups are running now in the state of Georgia, because there was a time there where there was hardly anything going on in the state. And you remember that this was the capital of wrestling, you know, going back to WCW and before that, you know, where TBS and Gordon Soley and everything. And Atlanta was the capital of wrestling. And then it became pretty much a dead market for many years, other than WWE coming to town. And now it's gone through a renaissance of all these different
promotions. Also, too, there are a number of occasions where there's some of the indie shows that actually came in within the Atlanta city limits would put on some purposely really, really bad shows and left a really bad stench in there. I read some stories and talked to some folks who know a lot about the Atlanta area and industry, where there's some guy put on a show at the International Ballroom in Doraville. Doraville is a northeastern suburb of Atlanta. And it was supposed to be an all midget wrestling.
I remember that. Yeah.
At the International. Yeah. And I believe they had like two matches start. Had a good crowd. Had like two matches start. Then all of a sudden there was a delay. Then all of a sudden the promoter and the four wrestlers who were there all left. and there were variations of these kind of crooks things going on constantly in the Atlanta work. And I think that had a lot to do with how unpopular the wrestling, the taste of wrestling was for a lot of Atlanta area things. I think that was probably a contributing factor.
Yeah, and what's fun is watching these old towns that Georgia All-Star used to run or Southern used to run, like Carrollton, Canton, go up in the North Georgia. Yeah, Barnesville, you know, has become a hot market again. I mean, just a lot of these old towns that didn't have wrestling or good wrestling for a while, they're starting to pick back up again, and it's just so fun to watch. And and seeing you and Scott at the last WrestleAmerica show was kind of like that combination of the old guard and the new guard, and it was so good to see y'all there. So and I haven't heard your guys' commentary yet, but I'm sure it is a blast, because y'all had a hell of a match on that show. The announced, you know, the AJ and Doc Gallows against Jimmy Ray Masaranaro match, which tore the house down.
Oh, that was wonderful. It was a fantastic match, and it was really, really easy to call when the continuing talent playing on another ring. Remarkable.
Yeah.
Stuff, yeah. It was a gap.
Well, Scott had to dip out because he has to get up in about 6 hours, he told us. So we've been just talking for the last few minutes, but, you know, real quick as a summation, your time in wrestling as an announcer or doing other things, what do you think of it? I mean, do you think that you could have done more? You think you did enough? What is your opinion on your career?
In wrestling, I think I did all I really wanted to do. I made a bit of a play to actually I spoke with Disco for a while there. During the WCW thing, doing some sort of a gimmick with who was that guy? Ricky Rackman.
Yes.
Yeah, there was some chat about actually getting some sort of feud going on between me and him.
Oh, that would have been hilarious.
Which which would have been, I don't think it got out of conversation really, but I would have liked to have maybe been able to snuck in a couple, maybe snuck in a few months worth of fun stuff with WCW, but that would probably really be the only real regret. I got a chance to be involved in a lot of fun, so much fun stuff, calling great wrestling, calling some really bad wrestling, and doing it all with my best friend, which is such a treat. The time I spent in wrestling was frankly enough. I couldn't really have asked much for much more. So I'm really happy. And Scott and I still got the occasional opportunity, to do that voodoo that we do so well, every once in a while again. About a couple of years ago who's the MVP there at TNA? I forget his name. Ring announcer.
Borash.
Jeremy Borash. Yeah, he had some old tapes of a tour of Australia that he had with
WWE.
Number of years ago. WWE with that Public Enemy when they were still with us, obviously, and some others. And he had Scott and me put a new commentary on those after the fact. And it was a gas to do that there too. So it's nice to be able to still have those opportunities to do these things on a regular basis. So that's wrestling is never really far behind. But happily, I've got my chance to do so much and with a great quality and with a lot of fun and with all the shits and giggles that I've always wanted to. I have included in there. I've been able to do that as well. So I still got a silly grin on my face. I'm really, really happy with the time and the people that I've spent in this crazy industry. No regrets here.
That's awesome. That's awesome to hear. Well, do you have anything going on right now or in the future that you want to plug?
Nothing really at the moment. Doing with real life, whatever. We're doing housework, working on the yard, doing that voodoo that I do so well. So there you go.
Now, you're not calling matches between like house pets or anything, are you?
I don't know. Only if I'm doing it in my sleep, actually. It's funny because you brought up something a few minutes ago that I didn't even realize. Both Scott and I replaced Chris Cruz. He did it in WCW, and I did it in Wild.
That's right. I replaced Chris Cruz. Because he was with NCW.
That's right, yeah.
Which became Wild.
Yeah, he was. I couldn't get up. Chris Cruz was this outrageous spittle flying heel commentator. I never heard so much vileness coming out of a heel commentator, and it was from a pro like Chris Cruz. What the hell happened here? So I haven't been wrong. That's something else that I have in common. We both replaced Chris Cruz.
Hey, that's something to hang your hat on, no doubt.
No, I don't think it's okay.
Well, I'll tell you this. This has been a great show, I thought, and I was so glad to do this with you guys, and definitely whenever I decide to do that Wild Side show, you and Dan, I think that'd be more magic there to get you guys back together again for a show like that, and we might get Al Guest to get on there too, because he was around for some of that stuff.
Sure was. I had a great time calling that.
Yeah, I love Al. Love Al to death. But anyway, like I said, glad to have you guys on the show. Next Exile on Bad Street's coming up next week, where I got Bo James coming on and Carl Sturm from Wrestling Observer. We're going to talk about Continental Championship Wrestling, going over the beginnings of that promotion and probably the first year or two. So that'll probably be part of our next series. Of course, we just finished up the three-part series on the history of Smoky Mountain Wrestling, which a lot of you guys that listen are received very well. So glad for that. And Between the Sheets, of course, every Monday with my co-host David Bixenspan. Of course, the latest episode was focusing on 1993, Cowboy Bill Watts getting canned from WCW. We have the audio that got him canned, and a lot of people were interested in hearing that. Stuff that, very few people had heard up until a few years ago when Wade put it up on the Torch website. So a lot of great stuff on that show. And our next show will be covering 1997, Shawn Michaels losing his smile and all that great stuff, which is a fun time period for WWF. So be on the lookout for that. And that's all we got this week. So Scott, who's not with us, and he's still alive, he's not with us. For Steve, of course, and for me, saying so long for the Peach State of Georgia.